Greetings! At Urban Buzz Magazine, we're all about the music, all about the culture, and today, in the midst of Black Music Appreciation Month, we're all about celebrating and saluting the legendary Melba Moore! All right! Welcome, Melba!
Thank you very much!
Thank you, and thank you for sharing time and talk with Urban Buzz Magazine. Congratulations on your brand new album, Imagine! Now, the first single, So In Love, reached the top of the UK Soul chart, and it's followed by your latest number one single, Take Her Picture Down. And there's also the wonderfully produced Take Me Away, as well as the inspirational, beautiful title track, Imagine. Now, you've conquered Broadway, and you've had major triumphs as a recording artist in R&B, dance, pop, rock, and to my ears, this new album has that classic quiet storm, soul sway, albeit in a contemporary way. Now, as I understand it, the project is very much a friends and family affair with your daughter, Charlie Huggins, at the production helm?
Correct, yes.
That's fantastic. I have a question. Will there be a hard copy CD?
Yes, as a matter of fact, the promotion people are in the process of getting that out.
I have the digital, but I would love to read all the credits, the songwriters, arrangers, who's on trumpet on Take Her Picture Down. Love it. All right, now being open to new creative challenges seems to keep you forever young, forever Melba, forevermore. You're still looking great. You sound great. Now, especially during these past few years of COVID and a host of ongoing challenges, is there a fitness routine that keeps you healthy and stage ready?
Yes, stay away from the contagion.
Yes, that too, but I'm also speaking holistically, not just physically, but also spiritually and, of course, vocally.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Well, I'm Catholic, so when I'm not doing anything, I go to Mass every day, I receive communion every day. I believe a born-again Christian, so God is first in my life, middle and last.
Excellent. So, well, I'm raising my hand here because I was raised Catholic, so as we used to say in Mass, praise God from whom all blessings flow.
Absolutely. That's my mantra.
All right. Now for a little rhythm and roots. Now, you have a wonderful career that covers many genres. And as a longtime Melba fan, as well as a jazz man, I happen to know you're from an extremely musical family. Would you share a little with us about your early years? Yeah, and the Teddy Hill Orchestra had Dizzy Gillespie, Roy Eldridge, Bill Coleman, major.
Yes. You said it better for me, yes. Yeah. My mother, Mary, who was a piano player, and they worked together. They had what they used to call a combo, it was a group together. And before that, when my mother was just a single parent, I had no siblings and no relatives living near me. So my family was very broken. Mm. My mother married my stepfather. He had a son and a daughter. So now I had a sister and a brother. And then later on, we had two more brothers. And my stepfather also had many sisters and brothers, so I had aunts and uncles. That's very important because your family is your first community. And they were all musical, so I was kind of grafted into a very, very musical family. And that wasn't until I was 9 or 10 years old. So I didn't really find out that I had a voice until I was, 9 or 10 years old, which is kind of late, because if you can sing, you have a voice naturally, you would know that by the time you're 4 or 5 years old. So everything came to me kind of late, but it did come.
It did come. Let me ask you, I read that somewhere that dance was one of your early passions, like tap, and maybe you took ballet, or is that so?
Yeah, my mother took me to, there used to be a school called Mary Bruce, and she gave me dance lessons, and I fell in love with it. I was about 5 or 6 years old. I loved dance, and so whenever I could, I studied dance. So I studied with Adam Ailey's troupe that taught at the White SCA on 50th Street and 8th Avenue in Manhattan. And let me tell times that I had an opportunity, I always took dance class.
That's fantastic.
I'm also one of the first people to take Pilates. Everybody's heard about Pilates now.
Yes.
But before, all the athletes and dancers used to take it because it was a treatment, really, for dance injuries.
I remember. I danced as well. So what did we call it? The reformer? I remember being on that machine and very, very helpful. Now, your stepfather, Clem Mormon, if I'm not mistaken, I believe he performed for at least 60 years, maybe well over 60 years.
Yeah.
And I know he encouraged you all, and he encouraged you to take piano lessons. Do you still play?
I don't. I haven't for quite some time.
Yeah, but you still have that bass. You have that root, and I bet you pick up a piece of sheet music and you know what's before you.
Well, through piano, we learned the rudiments, how to read. And then eventually, I majored in music in high school and then college, and I taught music. So it'll never leave me.
Excellent. I know you went to the High School of Performing Arts in Newark, and then you went on to Montclair State College, got your BA degree in education, and went on to be a teacher. Now, I read that when you became a teacher, you began singing with other faculty, and you guys formed a cultural group, Voices, Inc. Is that true?
That's correct. Yes.
Absolutely. I know, like, on YouTube, there's a National Education Television series, History of the Negro People, and there's an episode on slavery that opens in 1619 with you singing a lyrical, almost classical version of Carry Me Back to Old Virginia, and that's juxtaposed with Voices Inc. singing Oh Freedom, Freedom Over Me. And Ossie Davis and Ruby Dee present actual testimony from former slaves. It's very powerful programming and a very powerful group. And I guess I said all that to say, to note that social consciousness, or art as activism, is definitely part of your roots. And we are so thankful for that. You know, you should be recognized for that. And that's what I'm doing right now. Now, let me ask you, back to the showbiz part of it. How did you start as a session singer?
I chose school because my parents, wanted me to have some backup and some security financially.
Yes.
And then after I did that for about 2 years, I said to my parents, well, this is what you wanted me to do. I'm very good at it, but I'd like to try to be a performer too. So could you try to help me get into the industry? And so my stepdad started taking me around to some of his colleagues and trying to get me to piano bars and the type of places that they work in. So he took us to some entertainment office buildings, like the Bill Building, that did all the different buildings up and down Broadway that have agents and managers and all different kinds of where you could inquire to get into the industry. And in one of them, somebody was sitting in one of the offices by the name of Valerie Simpson. So we just started talking, exchanged numbers, and she involved with singing jingles and doing video backup work, and she invited me to come do some sessions for her, and that's how I got into the industry.
I remember reading that. I remember that you and Valerie, and maybe Nick Ashford as well, sang background on Bobby Heap's Sonny. And you provided backup tracks for Aretha Franklin, Dionne Warwick, Johnny Mathis, Frank Sinatra, and Harry Belafonte, Liza Minnelli. I know the list goes on. It's fantastic. Now, one of those voiceover sessions, is it true you met the composer of the musical Hair?
Mm-hmm. He was a keyboardist as well, the music director, as well as, had composed a lot of, helped compose all of the music for the Broadway musical Hair, and they were still casting for the show, so we asked everybody that was singing on the date to come down and sing for the director and the producer, and there were fine places in the show for us. Nobody else on the set, there were
that's fantastic. And after several months, you wound up replacing Diane Keaton in the role of Sheila, becoming the first African-American actress to replace a white actress in the lead role on Broadway. That's great, man. Now, being in here, that puts you smack dab in the middle of one of Broadway's first counterculture cast, a.k.a. The Tribe. Now, how do you remember those times? All those people, Ronnie Dyson, Ben Vereen, Donna Summer, your friend Laurie Davis. how I guess it was quite an experience.
That book goes on too. There's so many wonderful people came out of that show as solo artists. I'm not going to remember them all, but you spoiled a lot of people. First of all, they broke all the rules in every, which way. They opened a realm of world at the same time. Each of them shows open on Broadway, or maybe they start in UK and then they come to the US and then they go to LA and then they go on tour. But they opened according to the astrological signs, so they opened all over the world. So at the same time that the Broadway show opened, Donna Summer opened in Germany.
That's right. When I landed in New York, and now it was 15 or so years later, but everybody let me know about Lamont Washington. Very talented.
He died in the fire.
Tragic. It's just tragic. And we lost Lynn Kellogg to COVID not that long ago.
I did not know that.
Yep.
For a while, they were able to keep in touch with her, but not over the last couple of years.
Yeah, man. But it's what times, man. In 1970, you won a Tony Award for Best Supporting Actress in a Musical for your role as Lootie Belle Gussie Mae Jenkins in Pearlie, as well as the Theater World Award and the Drama Desk Award for Outstanding Performance. Now, how was it like being part of the Pearlie cast?
Oh, that was absolutely wonderful. It's like going down south and visiting your family.
Mm-hmm. Clavon Little, Sherman Hemsley, Linda Hopkins, Novella Nelson. Just fantastic. Now, listening to that cast recording, I wondered, when did you first begin going up an octave for the endings of the songs, I Got Love and Pearlie? Was that a complete surprise to everyone, or definitely a welcome surprise?
Well, to everyone except the lady who was the music director for Pearlie, Joyce Brown, because she had also written the song for the music director for him, so she knew what my range was.
Mm-hmm.
I never auditioned for Phil Rose, who was the producer and director of the show. When he auditioned me, he never heard me sing, so he didn't have a clue.
Oh, my goodness.
It was a focus, and it came as the biggest shock to me. Phil was a wonderful, wonderful person and director, and he also was responsible for taking Pearlie to film, which extended his life so much longer. So many people have seen Pearlie on film, we never would have seen it if they had, missed it.
The version with Robert Guillaume, right?
Correct.
Excellent. And I'm so glad it exists as well. Now, after all those high-profile successes, celebrated albums, hit singles, and Grammy nominations followed, as well as starring roles in film and television, and, of course, on Broadway, now, you signed with Mercury Records, you recorded 3 albums for them, and you received your first Grammy nomination for Best New Artist in 1971. But your last LP on Mercury, Melbourne Live at New York Philharmonic Hall, is an absolute favorite of mine. Is there any chance of a CD or a remastered digital release of that live LP?
I'm
going to
look into it because it's a very special set of songs and performances of that live LP.
That's my first LP of yours and the first time I ever heard You're Lean on Me.
That's the first time I performed it.
It's just fantastic. A New World Coming, Blue Sky, Summertime, A Great God Bless the Child, Never Can Say Goodbye. It's so good. So good. All right. Now, 1972 must have been a particularly exciting and probably exhausting time for you. You got albums to promote, you're still on Broadway and Pearlie, and CBS contacts you about doing your own television series, The Melba Moore Clifton Davis Show. And that was must-see TV at my house. Now, how involved were you two in the production of that series? Did you get to pitch any ideas for skits, songs, or guest stars? I mean, I'll tell you something about that. I mean, I'll skip back a little bit, but I used to sneak and stay up at night to see you on the Johnny Carson show. Not just for the great music, but I remember the Afrocentric gowns, the cornrows swooping up into a great big Afro puff. I say, like, wow, I miss it. I miss that. Beautiful. All right. Now, while the Melbourne Clifton show was very successful, I know the relationship ended, and that so ended another show. And at the same time, I read there was like mismanagement, financial woes, and some serious health issues you had to deal with. Now, I only mention that here because there's a misconception among many that fame equals instant happiness, or at least security. And oftentimes, really, only challenges are guaranteed, you know. But, you know, you come through that fire, but still you rise, as Maya Angelou would say.
That's a perfect way to describe that period, because I was on top of the world, and I was ecstatic in St. Louis, but you were scared to death all the time, because you were always on the top of a mountain peak and not knowing how you were going to get down.
Wow, you know what? But oftentimes, that is the journey. You know, oftentimes we
there's no peak.
Yeah, we don't settle in one place. It's gonna whoop. It is up and down. All right. Well, listen. In 1975, alongside your then husband Charles Huggins, you formed Hush Productions. Now, eventually, the company gained a soul stellar lineup of artists like Freddie Jackson, who I know you brought to the label, as well as many others. But in the early days of Hush, did you and Charles create a career map of where you wanted to go? You sit down and plan the best roads to take you there?
Well, we tried to get managers, but nobody would take me because they said, he was looking for someone who would help us conquer the recording industry.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, there really wasn't a whole lot of people who had conquered theater and then came to recording. The theater was white, and the record audience, the black people were black.
Yeah. You know, in a way, there's still that prejudice between Broadway and pop or R&B radio. There's still a dividing line there. But when you did get to a record label, post with Charles, I believe it was Buddha Records, and the first album, Peach Melba, has a second side that is on my playlist to this day. That's 100 proof truth I just said there. The second side of Peach Melba, I still play to this day. And the beautiful single, I Am His Lady, definitely Grammy worthy in both pop and soul categories. Do you have any memories of that experience? Like Bob James, Dave Grusin, I know Eugene McDaniels might have been the producer.
He was the executive producer, the overall producer. Yes, matter of fact, we recorded most of that at Eugene McDaniels' home, up in the mountains in L.A. on the West Coast.
It's beautiful. It really, and Morgan Ames.
It sounds like that. I feel like it really sounds like where he lives, up in the hills and the forests.
Beautiful album. And then came This Is It. Smash albums, smash single. And I know that album included your first studio version of what many consider your signature song, the Van McCoy penned ballad, Lean On Me.
Right, that was the second time we had it.
Yep, now that earned you another Grammy nomination, this time for Best Rhythm and Blues Vocal Female. But there were a bunch of hits from that album, though. Not only This Is It, I think there was a dance hit called Free, and in my house, Brand New Me. We loved that album. Well, the labels changed, but your hit train just went full speed ahead. You had pop and dance classics like You Stepped Into My Life, and later on, My Heart Belongs to You, as well as power ballads like The Long and Winding Road and The Other Side of the Rainbow. And plus, you received a Grammy nomination for Best Female Rock Vocal for 1985's Read My Lips. Well, it's uncharted territory for us in many times, unless we're Tina Turner. But in addition to a string of hit records, there were also challenging acting roles. I saw, and I have a copy of the film version that you did of Kurt Vile's Lost in the Stars. Yep, you did Harriet Tubman in A Portress of Courage, project. And on the sitcom side, you returned to CBS to star in Melba. And that was another family-friendly favorite in my neighborhood. All right, now you also went back to Broadway to star in Timbuktu, along Eartha Kitt, William Marshall, and Gilbert Price. And in 81, there was Innocent Black. I believe you contributed to the score there, along with McFadden and Whitehead?
Correct.
Excellent. And in 1996, to much critical acclaim, you took over the role of Fantine in Broadway's Les Miserables, becoming the first Black actress to step into a leading role in that mega musical. That's major. Now, I have a question here. Somewhere in the vaults, maybe waiting for the appropriate project, have you recorded I Dreamed a Dream?
I have not.
Oh, man. Okay, well, this is my next question. Is there a Melba Moore Return to Broadway LP waiting in the wings?
Hopefully there'll be a soundtrack, and there'll be a play, and then there'll be music, and then there'll be a recording.
I gotcha. And that, of course, that's a great transition, because are there still plans to bring Still Standing, the Melba Moore Story, to Broadway or another New York venue?
I'm not sure about a New York venue, but what I want to do is, I've written it and produced it myself, and I'm not a playwright.
Yes.
So as soon as I have a minute to breathe, I'm going to get a production team together and finish the play and tour it and then see where it wants to go.
Now, I'm assuming like many publishing companies have vied for the rights to your autobiography. I've even read that you've already written a book, but I've yet to find it. Is that something you would ever consider, your autobiography?
I've been talked with a major company to do an autobiography, a memoir.
Excellent. Excellent. Now, Melba Moore, you're also a lifelong civil rights activist. You marched with Coretta Scott King and Reverend Jesse Jackson, and you worked closely with the National Council of Negro Women and the National Political Congress of Black Women. Your version of Lift Every Voice and Sing, the Black National Anthem, was added to the United States National Recording Registry and preserved by the Library of Congress as an American oral treasure. Now, what was the genesis behind that project, bringing in all of your friends, Dion, Stevie, just wonderful. Is that your idea?
Once I was given the idea by Dr. Dorothy Hyatt, who was the chairperson of the National Council of Negro Women. She had invited me to be a membership chair for her, just going on, bringing up awareness of the events that she was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And she invited me to sing the Negro National Hymn. For one of the prayer breakfasts, and I had to tell her I didn't know that we had one. I didn't know what it was. And when she said, well, you got to go to work, or you have to find out who James Holden Johnson is, and see your heroes. And once I did that, I realized a lot of African-Americans did not know we had an anthem that identified our struggle and our fight for freedom here. And so I went to my then company, Cadillac Records, department was headed by Scott Stolz, who is African American, and he was at the study with me, and he thought it was a great idea, but I told him, I don't think you should do it as my solo, because people might think it might hit records. Why don't we invite some other iconic African American artists, and we got permission from the NAACP, who owns the rights to the Dirty Boys and Saint, and dialed in and make sure that we can make money off of it, even when we gave it to them. And so that together we will promote it as our national anthem and to make people aware of it as it became popular.
Well, it's a fantastic production and a fantastic video. You, the people I mentioned, the Clark sisters, Anita Baker, Stephanie Mills, BB and CC, Take Six, just a fan, and Jasmine Guy dancing around. I think Debbie Allen directed it.
Debbie Allen directed it, yes. Bill Gossett did the video, and Jesse Jackson did the audio.
I remember. Yes, Lou is in the video, and Jesse Jackson is on the record. I think that album is Soul Exposed, and it ended with the phenomenal version of Stormy Weather. I think you blew my speaker out on that one. Now, this August, you're scheduled to receive a well-deserved Lifetime Achievement Award for your years of community service from President Joe Biden. Excellent. So many mountains you've climbed, so many milestones and incredible journey, so many doors you've opened, so many people that you've shined a light on to say, hey, come this way. Yeah, you can dream this. If you can dream this, you can do this. So I just want to take time to thank you for that. Thank you so much. And to ask you, what are you most proud of at this point in your career?
New album. That's a full-time job. I don't know how long it's going to take because things are so different than they were, you know, 10, 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. The system, they're all expanded and people have, you know, followers of a million people.
Yeah.
It's just very, very different. So I'm going to take my time with Imagine.
But I tell you, you have a winning project. You have a winning album in Imagine. It crosses multiple generations. I think it appeals to everyone. You know, if you like romance, you will like this, you know. From the heart, it has truly been an honor speaking with you. I want to thank you for always standing right here, representing and raising us up. Thanks again to the wonderful, the one and only Melba Moore. Thank you so much for sharing time with Urban Buzz Magazine. Bless you.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right.
Enjoy the day. Have a very successful day.
Oh, you too. Thank you so much. Melba Moore's new album, Imagine, is available now for digital download. It's on all streaming platforms, and CDs are on the way. But the title track was an immediate standout for me, both the music and the message. A place for love, a place for peace. Can you imagine?